People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ain't ought to be. Tonight, I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fucking dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They live on our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a foreign dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Real life, I'm fighting in a foreign dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, so much to talk about, and I want to thank Stan Hess for sending this my way, and this is a warning about miscegenation, particularly with blacks. It's called Mud Shark Madness, and for those of you who just might not be up on slang terms, a mud shark is a white female who has sex with blacks. From the Do I Give a Flying Flock? That's what I said, flock department. Here's a few photo montages of white women who became involved with blacks and paid the ultimate price for their stupidity. I can't entirely blame them, however, since the largely alien media constantly brainwashes our race to breed ourselves away. So hypocritical considering how this arrogant race does everything possible under the radar, or even quite openly over in Israel, to limit this kind of thing among themselves. In other words, Jews constantly oppose going outside their race or breeding outside their race, but much of the Jewish media is only too happy to promote miscegenation among ourselves. And the writer, this is not me, but the writer says, I hate to get graphic about it, but these foolish white women were stabbed, slashed, shot, strangled, smothered, slugged, stomped, had their faces and heads bashed in by anything convenient, maybe even burned alive by the Negro they were with, gone bonkers about something or other, enough to murder that white bitch. When things go really bad, these violent, crazy blacks might run off and slaughter the women's white friends, relatives, or even new white boyfriends, should the fool finally come to her senses. Do I believe there's a purposeful effort to push miscegenation or race mixing by the largely Jewish money elite through the media? You're darn right I do. It's all part of the insidious politically correct crap designed to mess with our heads and destroy the white race as much as possible. If you think that's bull, then largely Jewish media brainwashing must have screwed you up in the head too. This is a photo montage. Scroll down for a big fat dose of what is being done to the white race. Data from way back in 1985 revealed that white women are 12.4 times more likely to get murdered by a black husband or boyfriend than a white. That's 1,240% more than white male killers of their white female cohorts. So few white males take up with black women, the numbers of interracial murders, you know, black men killing white women, are practically non-existent. Those are very interesting facts. We're always being told, well, it's a matter of choice. It is a matter of choice. And some choices are just statistically not good. Yes, one could string a wire across Niagara Falls. And some people have actually, on such a high wire, walked across the falls and survived. There have also been many people who've done that and not survived. It's a high-risk activity. And interracial sex, particularly for white women with black men, high-risk activity, a much greater risk of being beaten to death or mutilated or maimed than if they take up, as they should, with a white man. And the writer says, and I'm absolutely certain it's much, much worse today, with blacks going criminally haywire across the board. It's hard to pinpoint exact numbers in America where the Department of Justice actively works to obfuscate black-on-white crime numbers to keep us white people in the dark. One simply has to use common sense. That little birdie inside that warns you that blacks can be dangerous and unpredictable. Also, pay close attention to local news, even though that's heavily manipulated for politically correct purposes, usually by not showing the photos of both the perp, usually black, and the white victim, in the same report, or showing any sad shots of any grieving white family and friends. So few of us white people can put two and two together on just how murderous some blacks are. You might also notice that the media purposefully using any black friends or even just neighbors for TV visuals and interviews, continuing the multicultural propaganda angle. Nor do they follow up all that much down the road. Greatly abbreviated trial coverage again drops white victim shots and reports as few gruesome facts of the case as possible. Sometimes even refrain from showing any photos of the black perp while in court, especially if the crime is really terrible. Nothing to see here, white people, move along. Still, you can figure out the real deal by reading between the lines, since the media can't totally censor crime locally, or too many whites in the area of the murder might start to notice and tell friends and family. And that's, of course, one of the values now of the internet, that these facts can be put out. Here's a picture of, or a series of pictures of whites murdered by their black boyfriends or husband. Christy Nicole Perez, 38, and her mother, Lori Susan Perez, 58, her black boyfriend shoots them both dead. There's Kiri Joris, 32, she's white with a big black eye, arrested for helping her black boyfriend shoot a guy dead in a laundromat. Deanna Passera, 27, arrested for sex trafficking minors with three black men. Brooklyn Ashbrook, a beautiful street blonde with blue eyes, 18-year-old Texas girl, bragged on Facebook about living her life as she pleased. Both her and her black boyfriend, who also pimped her out, gunned down on the street by a black hit squad, probably over the prostitution or drug business. Then there's this picture of a Negro nappy-haired male with his tongue sticking out, and kind of busty, pleasant-looking girl Willow Singer. What a lovely couple, modern couple. Only days after her husband dies from cancer, the mother finds her daughter's bloody corpse in the doorway when Black's ex shoots her multiple times to death and then himself. Oh, that's great. Then here's a Negro with glasses and, you know, these the way they braid their hair in these like little rat tails. Alexis V. Asarigian, 25, in a car with dreadlocked Negro who shoots her for some reason, and she dies in hospital. And here's a boyfriend on St. Valentine's Day, blows Kayla N. Fannin, 30, away, and she had the person by which she had a child, and a boyfriend, is a Black who looks like a gorilla, and the commentary is she actually had a child by this thing. And then there's Stephanie McNabb, 41, forces a way into a home, shoots her dead, Black shoots her dead, and wounds her, and so on. And there are others. It's a long, depressing litany of violence. The point made by the commentator is very apt. This is highly dangerous behavior, but that's behavior that is actively promoted by much of the media, and you know, this is the time where I think it's important to blame those responsible. Some people say, "Well, you can't blame everything on Jews." No, of course you can, and lots of white people lots of white people behave very badly on their own. However, there is a consistent propaganda theme in much of the Jewish-owned or Jewish-influenced mass media, and that actively promotes race mixing. And people notice this. Notice the advertising, interracial couples are strongly promoted. You're shown in advertising way out of keeping with their numbers. Now, Ilana Mercer is a Jewess, but she writes some pretty good material things. And this is a recent opinion column by her. It's called "It's Not Identity Politics, It's Anti-White Politics." Every time a manifestly racist anti-white event goes down, which is frequently, conservative media call it identity politics. The left is always playing identity politics. Whatever is convulsing the country, it's not identity politics. For Blacks are not being pitted against Hispanics. Hispanics are not being being sicked on Asians, and Native American Indians aren't being urged to attack the groups just above mentioned. Rather, they're all piling on honky. Hence, anti-white politics are animus. The ire of the multicultural multitudes is directed exclusively at whites and their putative white privilege. Anti-whiteism is becoming endemic and systemic. Take Empire actor Jussie Smollett. Smollett deceived the country and the Chicago Police Department about having fallen prey to a hate crime, which it transpired he had crudely orchestrated. The Chicago Police Department superintendent expressed the requisite righteous indignation that a Black man, Smollett, would desecrate symbols of Black oppression in the process of framing others. A noose had been purchased at Smollett's behest, and of course, bleach that was supposedly thrown at him. And yeah, I digress for a moment, but I am a weekly co-host of a program called The Ethnostate with William Johnson, the chairman of the American Freedom Party, and Ken Givenan, and usually other guests as well. And we commented, I guess it'd be about 3 weeks ago, this would be on the Tuesday, the day after the story broke. And we were very suspicious. we all we took the the initial allegations and concluded that, that this just doesn't smell right. For instance, Smollett alleged he'd been walking out on the streets of Chicago at 2 in the morning, whistle, police siren. What would you be doing walking around the streets of Chicago at 2 a.m., black or white? Anyway, so the story goes, he was approached by two men wearing MAGA, that's Make America Great Again hats, baseball hats, who one put a noose around his neck and the other apparently tried to throw bleach on him. And they made anti-Negro and anti-homosexual comments to him. Later, it was discovered he'd given them the comments to make. Oh, not reported. It's that these two people wearing Make America Great Again hats were actually black. That was not part of the original report. So the way it sounded was these two dreadful whites assaulted this poor actor at 2 o'clock in the morning, calling him mean names because he was black and homosexual. Now, as I say, the alarm bells went off. And one was, of course, what's he doing walking around at that time in the morning? Night in Chicago, which is a pretty dangerous city. Secondly, what would two people, men, be doing walking around at the same time? One actually having to have a noose with him. Is that very likely that a man, white or otherwise, would normally be walking around the street and just happen to have a noose in his pocket? Oh, and the other fellow just happened to have a bottle of bleach. Now, your common sense would say that this doesn't sound very likely. Now, just to look at him, of course, you know that Jesse Smollett is a Negro. So, okay, maybe anti-Negro insults, but how would anybody know he's a homosexual? People who didn't know him. The whole scenario should have, maybe it did, alert anybody with the brain of a banana quit to say, that doesn't sound likely. Anyway, the story did unravel. And back to Alana Mercer's commentary. Nobody, Superintendent Eddie Johnson included, said sorry to the accused group whose reputation had been sullied. And the accused group, of course, were Trump supporters or white persons. Even the Chicago police did not apologize. But look, we were at least initially somewhat taken in, and we're sorry. No, don't hear that. Conservatives, on the other hand, persist in skirting the white animus issue. The smaller libel fit the progressive narrative, some maintain. Overuse has made the narrative sound like a bad cliche. It was right versus left matters, insisted others. Smollett was sick in the head, came another obfuscation. What would public expiation and excuse making be without the bad habit of diseasing behavior? It's not, and she makes a good point. Sometimes people do bad things. They're not sick. They're not this cuckoo. No. Smollett, I think, was rash. Not very bright. You don't have to be very bright to be an actor. His motive was greed. He wanted more money for his role in Empire, and he thought if he could make himself the victim, and then he goes and makes his demand to the production company management, how could they turn him down? Look, he's a martyr. He'd been attacked as both a Negro and a homosexual. Anyway, I think she makes a good point here. His antics might still make him a big-time actor, but Smollett is a small-time crook, a common criminal of low character. To disease immorality is a corruption of traditional conservative thinking. In other words, her phrasing it is a little awkward, but there are people who do immoral things. And when you do immoral things, doesn't mean you're sick. That's it's not an excuse. He made an immoral choice, or an evil choice. We have a politicization of crime, reasoned other conservatives. Come again? What is the hate crime category if not a politicization of crime? With the hate crime designation, we are essentially saying that a murder committed with a racial malice is worse than one committed without it. Is that a normative call or a political call? I say it's the latter, says Alana Mercer, and she's right. I've always been opposed to designating things as hate crimes and making them worse. If somebody assaults you because they're just in a bad mood, and they punch you in the nose, on the other hand, somebody assaults you because you're, let's say, Negro or you're homosexual or whatever, your nose is still broken. And the reasons don't matter much. It's the assault that's the problem. Some conservatives remark that the Smollett affair occurred against the backdrop of Trump derangement syndrome, or TDS. Is TDS not a proxy for the white-hot hatred of whites? Yes. 4 minutes and 13 seconds in, a video filmed at the Washington State Evergreen College gives way to softly hissed but deranged diatribes by faculty. Theirs is an unadulterated anti-white agitprop. Yet the TV host who screened this pedagogic incitement was almost lighthearted, focusing on secondary, lesser issues like victimhood chic. Never once is the thing called what it was, anti-white. Incessant and dangerous incitement to hate innocent whites for their alleged pigmental privilege. You see, we have white privilege, so they should hate us. Well, no, actually, just the opposite. With affirmative action, it's not whites that get the privilege, it's blacks, or in some cases, other minorities. A recent and jarring anti-white incident involved the curriculum imposed on students by the Santa Barbara Unified School District. As if public education is not sufficiently corrupt, educators now contract out to an educational black operative. These tax-paid mercenaries come to schools as social levelers to put your kids through an indoctrination boot camp. However, it's not egalitarianism the schools are increasingly teaching, but anti-whiteism. Just Communities Central Coast, or JCCC, is such an educational, in quotation marks, black op. The reported outcomes of the Just Communities initiative tells us a lot about the impetus behind the course. JCC's discriminatory curriculum has led to increased racial animosity toward Caucasian teachers and students, reports Eric Early, a Republican candidate for California Attorney General. American kids can barely read properly or speak and write grammatically. They'll never know the wonders of the Western literary canon, banished because produced by, you know, dead white males, mostly. But they've committed to consciousness ugly, nonsensical, stupid, decontextualized grids that tabulate the ways of white oppression. Talk about the closing of the American mind. Yet the litigant, a Republican candidate for California Attorney General, had a hard time coming out with it. JCC's anti-white teachings were merely anti-American, he told Fox News apologetically. And you want to say, is that all you've got, sir? It's not whether it's anti-American or not, it's anti-white. That's the crime. This is Alana Mercer continuing her commentary. I read Esquire's February 12th cover story featuring Ryan Morgan of West Bend, Wisconsin. Fox News' Martha McCallum called it provocative before inviting U.S. Army veteran Darren Porcher and activist actor Raimundo Kelly to trash the life of this American boy at 17. The only reason the humdrum story of poor Ryan Morgan was deemed provocative is because he's white. As it transpired from the disjointed thoughts disgorged by McCallum's two Negro guests, quote, there is more important people in the world than white middle class. So that's one of her heavy-duty Negro commentators. There is more important people in the world than white middle class. Ryan, incidentally, that's that poor boy who was supposedly insulting a Native Indian who actually was the one who was in his face. Ryan is not wealthy. He holds a job for which he rises at 6:30 a.m. before school. I put him in the working class category, says Alana Mercer. While Mr. Porcher conceded that we do not need to lend some credence to what a Caucasian man goes through, the irate Raimundo roared that Esquire dropped the ball on this. Raimondo could not quite explain why the experiences of white boys deserve to be expunged in the era of anti-whiteness and suicide rates rising among this very cohort, namely white American males. Indeed, the suicide rate is declining everywhere in the world except for America, where it's 12.8 per 100,000, well above China's current rate of just 7. Dubbed deaths of despair, white Americans and Native Americans are the most suicidal populations in the U.S. And that really is scary. Whites feel this certain despair, and I understand why. I from time to time read Lionel Mercer, and this was I thought a pretty good good commentary on her part, and looking for this next item here, and this is called People Canada 2009, Canada's the world's first meme country, and it's PeopleKind's current year. Justin Trudeau, our trust fund kid prime minister, corrected a questioner at a public gathering last year who used the word mankind, and he interrupted her, the pompous ass that he is, telling her it's people kind, madam. There's a picture here of Canada, capital Ottawa, area.
Canada, like most nations in the West, is currently in the process of revising its history to suit an ever-evolving sense of moral panic and retroactive indignation for those that created the nations that we live in today. As I have outlined on a recent video, that the nation's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, is having his statues removed. As well, he will be replaced on the $10 note. But these are not the only changes afoot at the Canadian Mint. In fact, 2019 will see the nation's $1 coin, nicknamed the Loonie for the loon that appears on its tail side, rebranded with an as-yet undisclosed representation of the LGBT community. This change comes during the reign of the current Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, a man whose gaffe-prone 2018 culminated in his state trip to India, where he played dress-up and pranced around on a stage for a bewildered audience, and has since become a global laughingstock. And he has not only done this to himself, but he has also brought shame and humiliation upon the Canadian people. It's therefore fitting that this Prime Minister, perhaps the most unskilled, unprepared, and unfit people kind to ever hold the office, is now about to virtue signal and pander to identity politics while the nation and its economy are on the verge of a major downturn and national cohesion is disintegrating. It's well known that Canada, via imported ill-gotten loot, and especially from China, has a bloated and already overpriced real estate market. In fact, in a recent study by Oxford Economics, only the dysfunctional housing markets of Sweden and Australia are rated more at risk, with Hong Kong and New Zealand rounding out the top five. To help pay for those inflated real estate costs, it has seen the average Canadian become the most indebted people on the planet. Canada's household debt levels are higher than any other country, and according to the OECD, its debt-to-GDP ratio has ballooned 101%, which is significantly higher than any of the other 35 developed and developing nations in the group that the organization monitors. The OECD also has stated that this leaves the Canadian economy particularly vulnerable to economic shocks. And as we well know, with economic downturns and horrific damaging events like those in 2008, it is not a matter of if, but when. At the end of 2018, we saw the worst single day of trading ever on Christmas Eve, providing record-breaking losses. as it capped the Dow's worst ever trading week since 2008. This in turn has had a knock-on effect on markets around the world as other indices have plunged. This is also having an effect on the Canadian currency and driving the loonie, soon to be the loon GBT, to its lowest trading levels versus the dollar since May 2017. And all of this is in the shadow of what geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan calls Canada's flirting with national crisis and the very real threat of Albertan withdrawal from Confederacy. More so, Alberta is the only province that is a net contributor to the federal budget and has been for years. As well, the compounded problems of a treasury fast depleting as mass retirement of boomers continues onward, and the looming inability to finance the tributary money used to bribe French-speaking Quebec to quell its own nationalistic aspirations. And even simple things like putting food on the table in Canada will be considerably more expensive in 2019, with the average Canadian family shelling out an extra $400 for groceries. All of these things, plus more, it would seem, are not a source of concern for Justin Trudeau. It could be that this is because Justin has been handed everything in his life, including the prime ministership, because of his name. Or it could be that he lacks the ethics required of a leader, as he has been found guilty of violating the Conflict of Interest Act, governing public office holders, or violations of ethics. Not once, twice, not three times, but four times. Four times he's been found guilty of ethics violations, but these violations conveniently carry no punishment. Or it could be, as I believe, his desire to virtue signal to the world and stay drunk via dopamine hits of self-congratulatory tolerance. He obviously does not care that he hurts the Canadian economy, and thus Canadians, via his ill-thought-out nagging of other world leaders. No, the only thing that matters is that he gives never-ending apologies to identity groups based on historical governmental policies and his desire to pander to every group possible he can prior to his run for re-election in 2019. And this is how we end 2018, with growing inequality between Canadians, national cohesion disintegrating, a slumping dollar, and, what is for most, unaffordable housing. Justin Trudeau, who himself is a former substitute drama teacher, is now not only playing dress-up, but playing at being a responsible leader. In June 2017, Justin gave a tearful apology toward those in the LGBT community for institutional federal discrimination that was in fact overturned before he was even born. Through his blubbering, he affirmed that $245 million, which includes money to compensate LGBTQ former civil servants who were terminated or sidelined because of their sexuality, as well as money for historical reconciliation, education, and memorialization efforts, well, this money, now included, will also be in addition to a dollar coin commemorating the 1969 laws that ended discrimination of sexual activity between same-sex adults. While I totally agree with Justin's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who, as Justice Minister at the time, said that there is no place for the state in the bedroom, these moves, however, of constant national flagellation of Canadians seems to have no end and plays into more identity politics precisely at a time when Canada has chosen a course of hyper-diversity for itself. But if this be the case, perhaps we should enshrine other laws that have recently overturned previous generations' morals, attitudes, and proclivities in the name of tolerance and the Church of Diversity. Perhaps we could change the Canadian flag to reflect this new tolerance and even the tolerance of the intolerant. The current version is only about 50 years old. Perhaps a new flag that incorporates the LGBT flag. But that's probably not going to be enough. With the various competing groups and those with absolutely and diametrically opposing ideologies all celebrating their differences and the fact that Canada's fastest growing religion is Islam, perhaps a compromise. Maybe something like this. Showing the world just how diverse Canada is. And Justin himself has said that returning ISIS fighters could be a powerful voice for Canada. Or perhaps given the fact that Justin himself is known as the Weed Man, and 2018 saw the legalization of marijuana, perhaps this incarnation to celebrate the stoners amongst us and reaffirm our sorrow and profound national disgrace at persecuting those that only like to spend their weekends playing video games with Cheetos dust-encrusted fingers while smoking on a joint. This design could set those wrongs to right. At the moment, there is the nickel, quarter, loonie, and toonie, the $5, $10, $20, $50, and $100 bills. With the loonie and 10 note already taken care of, that means there are still 7 currency denominations, both coin and bill, that could be changed to reflect our new religion of virtue signaling, as well as the sorrow we must feel for the actions and events that took place long before most of us were even born. We could go back in time and look at laws that we currently find reprehensible, like the Chinese Exclusion Act, or we could commemorate the 2016 Supreme Court ruling that legalized most bestiality in the country. Perhaps a cow on the front, a man on the back, both ensconced in a heart shape. I'm just spitballing here. Either way, Canada as a nation is increasingly looking like a meme country, and that is great for those that want to celebrate this newly achieved international notoriety. But something more profound to consider is that with all of this virtue signaling, it has got Canada nothing, as it is now more internationally isolated than it has ever been in perhaps the entirety of history. But that's okay, because things like inequality, bubble housing markets, debt, disintegration of national cohesion, none of these things matter, because Justin has great hair, likes to play dress-up, and flashes cool socks at ministerial meetings. And in that sense, Canada really did get the leader that it deserves. Thanks for watching. If you liked this video, please consider subscribing. Also, hit the alert bell. It rarely works, but give it a try. Also, follow Black Pigeon on the usual social media.
And that's a production by Black Pigeon. I think that's... that's really good. It's a good critique of Canada under the trust fund kid. Trudeau is a chronic virtue signaler. That's of course not the same thing as being virtuous. You know, there is a difference. A virtue signaler wants to say be seen to say the right things. That's not so saying the right things, apologizing to this group, apologizing to that group. Trudeau started off today, that's Thursday, with something of an explanation of his side on this growing scandal about his interference with his former attorney general in the SNC-Lavalin case. Now, SNC-Lavalin is a huge multinational Canadian-owned engineering company, and it's frequently been involved in corrupt practices and may well face criminal charges. Anyway, there's a way to try to avoid that, which would be called deferred prosecution. And Trudeau was massively pressuring his Native Indian Attorney General to do that, but she refused, and I think quite rightly refused. Anyway, it's become a real scandal, so he was trying to explain his side. Well, then he had to fly off to Iqaluit. Now, that doesn't quite ring a bell. Used to be called Frobisher Bay on Baffin Island. The reason for that was he was going to apologize to yet another group. Oh, who were these people? Well, these were Eskimos who had tuberculosis in the 40s and 50s and were flown for their own treatment, usually to southern Canada. Sometimes they died. In fact, the Eskimos are very vulnerable to tuberculosis for a variety of reasons. One would be genetic, but the other is the conditions in the Canadian Arctic are not all that good for people with any weakness in their lungs. That being the case, reason is that often there's intense dry heat indoors and brutal cold outdoors. Anyway, there's a high incidence of tuberculosis among the Eskimos, and they're now and back then. Canadian Arctic, what's now called Nunavut, has about 40-some thousand Eskimos spread over a vast territory. You know, if you look at a map, all the islands across the Canadian Arctic and some of the mainland are peopled by Eskimos. And the whole population in that vast chunk of frozen real estate is about 44,000, plus perhaps 20,000 whites who provide much of the infrastructure and services. Anyway, so a minute population. And it was even fewer, you know, half a century ago. So the way these people were treated was to fly them south to where they could be given better treatment, and also could be isolated from their families, so that because tuberculosis is a contagious disease. Well, some died and were buried there, and sometimes perhaps there wasn't the greatest sensitivity in returning the bodies to the communities where they'd come, etc. Well, we've got to apologize for that. You know, it is always the same thing. Old stock Canada, or the traditional Canada, or what I call the real Canada, under Trudeau, is always apologizing. Black Pigeon made the point about this recent apology to homosexuals who'd been dismissed from the armed services or certain other elements of the civil service for very good reason. They were considered a security risk because they were subject to blackmail. And certainly in the Cold War days, the Soviets were not above using sexual blackmail, but both heterosexual and homosexual to obtain information or to achieve control. Anyway, the government is always apologizing. And not only in most cases, there's really nothing to apologize for, but I would argue there's no authority to apologize. The policies of the governments today are different from the policies of governments in other times. That's the way you get change or reform. People today apologizing for policies that were pursued half a century ago by a different government, by different people, I would argue they have no authority to apologize. If it's a matter of making something right for somebody, compensating them, or in this case, if they know they return the bodies to the family, then fair enough, do that. But this drumbeat of apology is absolutely sinister, because it suggests constantly that we are bad, we are in the wrong. And it gets across the idea psychologically that maybe we're not worth preserving. And of course that is the end game, because our replacement is the absolute goal of Canada's genocidal, anti-white immigration policy. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fight side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. And I'm going to play Amber Digby. She's singing, "We're the Kind of People That Make the Jukebox Play."
Faces everywhere I go.
Amber Digby, we're the kind of people who make the jukebox play. Here's one with a duet with Vince Gill, The One I Can't Live Without. Great duet with Vince Gill and Amber Digby. You're the one you live with. Here's a great song, I think, by Bill Anderson. Whispering Bill Anderson. Great ballad. I Wonder If God Likes Country Music.
Talked a lot today about our friends at the Grand Ole Opry as we salute the Grand Ole Opry on Country's Family Reunion. I don't think anybody has mentioned the name of Roy Acuff, but I want to do that because some of my greatest memories of being on the Opry were the nights that Mr. Roy would come out on the stage and allow me to share the spotlight with him and do this song right here. I got a lot of wonderful memories. If we have time, I'll share some of you, but first, I'd like to do the song, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope maybe you remember. One night, we were out on tour getting ready to do a show. And at the time, it really wasn't anything all that special. It was what you might call just another one-night stand. When I looked over my guitar, and there stood an old man. His cowboy clothes were frayed and worn, and his boots were far from near. He said, I'd like to sit in with your band. He said, I'm a country singer too. Yeah, well, we just all had a big laugh. When I looked back at the old man, there was a tear in his eye. So I told the band to cool, because I didn't want to see him cry. He reached down and he took my guitar, and with a determined look on his face. But then as he started to play and sing, a look of sadness took its place. He said, I've sang my songs from Maine to California. Seen the world through the window of a car. I never made a dime back when I made it, never saved a dime.
Whispering Bill Anderson, this is Paul Frum, and you're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to wrap this up with Amber Digby, and You're Still on My Mind. This is Paul Frum.
Saying, and then I'll go home.
From here on the fighting side of me, back with you again tomorrow night, same time, midnight Eastern time. Shows repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Friendly.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace